Buongiorno everybody and welcome back for most of you guys. Did you have a good lunch?
Yes.
Yes, good. Lucky you, you had lunch. How many of you guys had a thrilling experience of coming to my morning session? Huh, less than I expected. So, for all the people that already came, I'm sorry, but for everybody else, I'll have to redo some introduction, but it will be short because this thing is a deep dive. It is, in fact, a deep dive on the Windows Azure Access Control Service. How many of you guys already used the Access Control Service? Not a lot. For how many of you, this would be the very first time that you hear about the Access Control Service? Some. Okay, so for you, I will make a bit of introduction. For everybody else, as soon as we are done in the introduction, we'll wear our long latex gloves and we'll shove our hands in the product. And I apologize for the graphic imagery, but it gives the idea. Also, the Access Control Service is one of those interesting things that provide you with a nice level of abstraction over complicated things. So, as long as you stay at the abstraction level, everything is very easy. As soon as you breach the abstraction, things can get very complicated fast. So, there is not this middle place where you do a good talk. You or bore people or you lose people on the way. So, I will rely on you guys to guide me and tell me what you want to hear. I will give you a list of things and we'll vote. And if you are not going to be interactive, when your loss. Okay? Yes, thank you. I already got you to nod. That's a major, major breaking point. So first, I'll make the case of ACS. Why did we even bother to come out with ACS, apart from, of course, becoming rich at your expenses? Well, if you didn't know about the business model, you'd know that it is absolutely not true. That thing is practically free. It's free, and in fact, until the end of a calendar year, it is actually free. Let's say that you can use it in production and not be charged. Then I'll just cover a bit of the structure, let's say both from the perspective of the endpoints, the protocols, and similar, but also a bit on what we have in the portal. And there we'll literally do the grocery list. We'll just go through those steps. But for what concerns structure, hopefully there will be some useful insights. And then after that, we can choose. We can pick the things that we want to dive in. And on the menu, I would offer things like understanding a bit better how to do the home realm discovery. We'll see in a moment what it is. A bit more about rules, how you can use the rules in access control servers for doing interesting things. Mentioning the management APIs, going a bit more into the details of what that means. And if you really, really feel that we want to be antisocial, we can dive into the protocols and token formats, which I really like. I don't know what that tells you about me, but for my job it helps. Anything else that you'd like me to add to that list? Future features. Thank you. I do have a slide for that. But that's not a future because we don't like a commitment. So it's things that we have on our radar. So we are thinking about that. Yes, sir?
Delegation of
OAuth. Delegation of OAuth. Great. Actually, let me add it. All right. Anybody else? One, two, three. Gone. Okay. The case for ACS. This eternal problem of mythical proportions. You have applications on one side, you have people on the other. How do I make the connection? In other words, how do I make sure that everybody can access the right things with the correct access levels, as opposed to being too closed or being completely opened? Well, the first step that we can use for making this problem tractable, at least, is recognize that usually users are affiliated with some kind of a higher level organization. So they can be belonging to a certain company, or they can all be, for example, happy owners of accounts with some webmail and similar. And so thanks to this, you can actually leverage this knowledge and use it for authenticating them. So you just put a little facade in front of those guys. You put some middleware, which is capable of interacting with this facade for actually performing the authentication, and bam, problem solved. Right? Right? Yes or no?
No.
Yeah, I'd be tempted to ask why no, but I know it's my fault because I'm being leading. Well, now you may not get it because I did a very subtle animation, and for which I'm very proud of. But as you can see, those little facades are changing colors. Let's say that the idea of putting a facade in front of the authentication capability is the correct idea. However, the devil is always in the details, meaning that if you actually look at the authorities that I have in there, all of those guys offer you this authentication capability, but everybody uses its own style. Where with style, I mean protocols, token formats, and similar. As a result, you can still use this approach. However, you've got to adapt your layer so that instead of having one layer, you have to add little details in here. How many of you guys ever used the Windows Identity Foundation? All right. How many of you know what the Windows Identity Foundation is? Almost everybody. And there is always at least one for which I have to say what it is. The Windows Identity Foundation is an extension to the .NET framework. Think of it as a DLL, which you can use in place of these green thingies. Let's say it's this middleware layer that you can put in front of your application. Now, when you have to support all those protocols, some of those capabilities will be actually baked into the platform. Some others you will have to write yourself. Ah, nice. Excellent choice, sir. Sorry, I saw my book. I felt I had to make positive reinforcement. You are not recording this, I hope. Or my manager is going to come after me. And so all those little things represent extensions that you can actually put in this middleware for handling all those fringe cases. And that is, in fact, what we are doing. Around protocols that are now en vogue, like OAuth, which do not come out of the box with Windows Identity Foundation, and we did provide extensions for that. However, if you have to do it yourself, it's a thankless job, because it's protocol details, those protocol details change, and this is also code which is non-strategic. Any code that you write and that your competitor writes and is exactly the same is non-strategic, is not giving you an advantage in respect to them. So that means it belongs to us. Gets worse. It gets worse because the differences in there are not just limited to the protocol, but also on the way in which the identities are described. And as a result, you may actually have to write special code for handling these. And for once among you here this morning, we made the little Chinese sample. That's what I'm talking about. I'll probably just show it again in a moment. So this idea of access control service is this, that we can put in this scenario an intermediary, a hub, if you will, where we actually put all this logic. Logic for handling protocols and logic for normalizing all the differences between the various sources so that your application can, again, be without any friction, can just think about the protocol at the high level. So that's the value of the access control service in a nutshell. Questions so far? That's trivial. Okay, so here, the people that were this morning here, they have to forgive me, but I have to do a very quick reintroduction to what I'm talking about. Let's say for making the multiple providers. So let me just make a very quick rundown of what I did this morning. See, that's one of the issues of this kind of talks, that if you have too close, like if I would have had just this one, I wouldn't feel bad in doing what I'm doing now, because I know that many of you just saw it. But I'm sure that you understand. So let's make a slightly more formal representation of what we have seen now. Here you have one user, and you have a directory for them, and you have potentially another user, and you have a directory for them as well. Let me just put it in a different color. And then you have your application, which can run wherever you want. This morning I spoke about applications running in the cloud. In reality, you can run it literally wherever you want. And then let's add our intermediary, which we have in here, which will mediate all our interactions. And let's add the Windows Identity Foundation in front of the app. This is represented as a piece of middleware. And here the flow goes as follows. Actually, for keeping you alive, I'll ask you what happens next, just in case, so that you feel a bit part of the process. It's largely an illusion. So here you have your user, opens the browser, lands on the application. Now, this application is configured not to authenticate the user directly, because we all know how claims-based identity work, but instead to outsource it to another entity. This entity, in this case, is the access control service. And it comes here. Now, in this case, the access control service can already show its value, in which it can take care of helping the user to pick which identity provider it should go from, which in this case we'd expect it's this one. And it will also take care of engaging that identity provider with the correct protocol, which may be arbitrarily different from the protocol that I'm using for the application. And here it is. And the result of this process is a security token, which I assume all of you know. And if you don't, I don't know if you remember that old movie, but it was Police Academy, when the two policemen, especially unlucky, they always end up in the wrong place. And there is a scene in which they end up in a club where they really didn't want to go. Well, if you don't know what a token is and you entered in this session, you are that policeman. So I apologize for giving you a bad experience, but you are still on time to go to another session. This moment, I think that there is Brian Keller, one guy from my team, who's doing this fantastic talk on Visual Studio. I highly recommend it. Anyway, the end result of this authentication is that you get a token from your identity provider, you send it to the access control service. The access control service can manipulate it in ways that we'll mention slightly later. And the result is that you can get this token normalized somehow and send it to your application. And here it can be analyzed as usual and similar. And similarly, this other side will follow the same. I'll hit the application, not authenticated, redirected on the access control service. Access control service shows me this page, and then I end up on my own provider. Here, let me grab another token, just in case. Too big. Let me make it red, since we are doing this from the red guy. We get it, we send it here. Here there will be some normalization. Those are the things that I described in the beginning as things that the access control service can be useful for. We send it back, and then finally we send it here, and then the result is that your application didn't have to deal with those details. I know it was a bit fast, but I'm hoping that you followed. Now, do you guys want to see a demo of that?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to do the demo that I did this morning. But first, I'd like to show you the access control service. Audience, the access control service, the audience. This is the visible part of the access control service. It's the management portal that you use for establishing the rules of your system. Rules that are basically telling the access control service which identity providers it should trust, how to transform the tokens that it receives, which format it should deal with, the cryptographic material that you will use for signing, and a lot of interesting things that normally you can ignore, but not today, because we are doing the deep dive. And here, my colleagues in the product team felt especially helpful that day, and so they decided to add on the homepage a little vademecum, that's Latin, I don't know how to say that in English, like a little guide for starting on how to get this access control service up and running. And this is, of course, an arbitrary flow. You can follow whatever system you want, but typically the first step that you do would be to pick one identity provider, one or more identity provider. You decide, from where do I want to get my users from? And here you have your UI that does just that. Then after this, you would tell to access control service about your applications. You can have more than one, you can have slightly different behaviors between those, so you need to tell to the access control service the details for how to approach those applications. Applications that in identity parlance are called relying parties, perfect. The R could be more rolling, but the concept is correct. And then after you have done that, you establish rules. Rules are the way in which you tell to the access control service how to process tokens. And also here you have a lot of discretion about what to do to which kind of tokens and similar. And then finally, you have to take some information which describes the access control service and feed it in your application. So that your application, instead of attempting to authenticate users on its own, it will demand things from the access control service. So let's do that very quickly. Here I have my list of identity providers. And my session expired, of course. So I was saying here I have my list of identity providers. I already have a Windows Live ID, which I cannot avoid. The way in which you become a customer of Windows Azure in general is by having a Windows Live ID account. So Windows Live ID is there. I can choose not to use it, which is exactly what I'm doing normally in my little demo. I simply do not check this for my application, but it's there. We are Microsoft, after all. And then here I already have one identity provider, which is a business identity provider. And I can actually go into the details. And this, giving to the access control service a description of your identity provider boils down to some basic housekeeping, like the name of the record that I will use for my namespace. I could use a shortcut for giving all at once the description of my system, which substantially means uploading a metadata file. How many of you guys ever saw a metadata file? 1, 2, 3, 4. It's a thrilling experience. Should we do it? Let's do it. No, it really isn't, but at least once in a lifetime, it's good to know why. It's good that there are tools that provide shelter out of that. So here I have XML notepad, yes. And I may have somewhere. Where should I keep it? No, later. SDR. Yes, here I have one metadata file, which we can quickly take a look at. A metadata file is a file which follows in typically as one of two standards. One could be WS Federation. How many of you guys ever heard the term WS Federation? Oh, good. Or SAML, the protocol. Yeah, I'm starting to like it. So, and basically, those two things are practically the same. The only difference is pure syntactic sugar, but the intent is exactly the same. Here, the intent is to describe your system in a way that potential partners or users can actually take advantage of that. And here, it's all XML, but it's easier to look at the tree view. And here, substantially, you need to do two things. One is saying, what is your role in life? In this case, the role in life of his entity is to be an identity provider. And so here I'm saying, I am a security token service endpoint. And not only that, I'm also a passive one, meaning that you are supposed to use me with a browser. Whereas if I'd be active, I would be using a web service, AWS Trust, correct. And once I establish this, then I actually advertise things such as the precise address where you should go and do all my requests, and other things such as, for example, which claims I am offering. And for example, here you have things like I'm offering the email address, I'm addressing the phone, offering the phone, and similar. And perhaps even more importantly, here I am also saying the cryptographic material you need to use to play with me. Again, you knew where you were going when you entered in a deep dive session. So here it's actually literally just the bits of a certificate. In the past, before we actually had the tools for consuming these, you had to provide all these things by hand, and you still can if you want. Instead now, let me go back to the access control service. When you create an identity provider, or conversely, when you provision one application, because you can also describe applications and relying parties using the metadata, then you don't need to do that simply because you just provide the file or the location of this file, and the access control service will do everything it needs for actually getting ready to send the tokens to you. In fact, not necessarily everything, because for example, if you want to encrypt the tokens for that application, you need to provide a certificate yourself. The access control service will not suck it up, but it does most of the work. Okay, here we have seen one. Actually, let's just add another since we added it. Here we can add various flavors of identity providers. We can add one business one, which is one that would be described by those metadata. All the other ones, they don't have that handy thing, mainly because they are based on web protocols, which are typically less robust, or in general less demanding. That's to say that exactly like it doesn't make sense to go to do groceries in a tank, then there you just use much less demanding requests. So I'm not disparaging them. I'm just saying normally you wouldn't use those for doing asking to your bank to do the payment of all the salaries of all your employees, but at the same time you wouldn't use elliptic curves cryptography for putting a comment on the blog of your friend. So when you use those identity providers, you don't have metadata, and you rely largely on previous knowledge. Let's say that we know the coordinates of Google, so if you wanted to add Google, well, let's add Google, why not? Here, you don't have to do much. The only thing you need to do is, hey, how do I want to call it? Maybe Google. And if you want to add one image here, you can do it, so that when you see that little graphic, you see the logo. Now, here there's one interesting thing that I should mention. Using logos of identity providers is not something that you can do like in relax. There are terms of use for images of those guys. And in fact, in the large, vast majority of situations on the internet, you see people using logos from those companies. And it's not clear if they can do that. Then, probably they will not come after you. Like, I don't know, I am not a lawyer and I'm very happy of not being. But in general, I would just ask you to exercise caution when you decide to say, oh yeah, I'm signing in with X, so I'll download the logo and I'll put it in there. There is a reason for which all our samples are without any logo. Because we are paranoid, not because we don't have a taste in visuals. And so here, I just hit save and I have Google. If instead I wanted to add a business identity provider, as we have seen, it's very easy. I'll give it a name. I'll provide a file, the metadata which we just had the pleasure to see what's inside. And I will just say, I don't know, org2. And that's it. And there are other options which I'll talk about in a moment. So now we have a bunch of identity providers. Good. So let's go back home to see what are we supposed to do next. Okay, we have to define our relying parties application. Let's go here and let's see what we have. Hey, we already have one described. So what does it mean to tell to access control service about our application? Well, again, we have a bit of housekeeping. Here, this is the name I want to use. Then we have a realm. The realm is a representation of the security domain where I want to go. Now, here there is another interesting point to do, which I wouldn't do if I wouldn't be in a deep dive. A URI is not a URL. Let's say that this thing could easily be URN semicolon something, no, colon something, meaning this is an ID, not necessarily one address somewhere. It doesn't have to be network addressable. Then, the vast majority of cases, you do both. Let's say that it's just handy. But you may come in situations in which you can't do that. For example, how many of you guys ever used the Windows Azure? Ah, look at that. You make my day, guys. When you use Windows Azure and you deploy stuff on staging, you don't know the address where you are going to have your thing until it's done. You get assigned this GUID and it's there. So if you would be using that identifier as the identifier here, you'd have issues. Also, if you are, for example, behind the load balancer and you have different nodes in your address, of course, you don't want to put all the stuff in there. So this one is a logical address. Then often is also in a network one, but important to know the difference. In fact, here we say return URL. This is the place where we are telling access control service to send back the token once they are done with all this token dancing. This thing is really interesting. This is something that actually was a problem for years and nobody ever did anything about it. And Caleb Baker, which is a colleague and also a good friend, came out with this idea of providing a URL on your system that can handle errors. What do I mean here? You have seen in my little diagram that when you use the access control service, you are bounced around like crazy. Like you can be a moment on your page, then on access control service, then on one identity provider, and potentially you can go on back and forth. When something of this froze, usually that's entirely out of your control. So let's say that you are federating with Google. You land in Google, you do something wrong when you try to authenticate in there, and you get an error. The error goes to your browser. It doesn't go to the application. As a result, your user is left in the cold. Let's say that you have to hope that Google is giving a good error message. And not only that, whatever message they will give, it will be out of context because it's not about your application. Google knows about your application only because there is a return address so that they can send stuff back. Well, with this URL, you can actually provide a place where when access control services sees that there is an error, it will send stuff in there. So you can still provide a decent experience or help them grief when something goes wrong. Then here you can choose between various flavors of tokens. I assume that you guys already know what is SAML. Good. No, and I wasn't waiting for an answer. I was deciding what to say next. I have to phrase the question in a way that you can show your hand instead of like all at the same time give me an answer. So how many of you know the difference between SAML token and SAML protocol? One. Okay, good. So I'm glad that I asked. Now SAML is a standard that came out maybe 10 years ago. This standard came out for solving one big problem at the beginning of the web, which was signing in across different domains. Normally, when you sign in a domain, you use a cookie. But the cookie is rightfully protected from access from everybody else. So if you want to sign in different places, then SAML came along and said, hey, here I'll teach your browser how to bounce through all those various entities, I'll give you another place where to put the information about the session, which is the SAML artifact. In the end, they are cookies, but they are still used in a way that you can actually sign in and sign out through different domains. So this one was a protocol. So a protocol as in a list of message formats and a list of possible flows and interactions. Among those things, they also defined one token format. Token format which is very handy, a lot of expressive power, and gives you all the tools for making this thing very secure. Very secure and very descriptive, as much as you want. Along came the time of the web services. After like this big browser thing, all those web services came out. It was more or less 2001. And I'm a big enthusiastic of that. My license plate on my car is WS Star. I'm not making this up. And it was an interesting time because the web services seemed that they were going to boil the ocean. And in the end, they boiled a couple of lakes. They still did some work, but they didn't take over the world. But anyway, web services were designed to work everywhere, not just in browser. And not only for doing sign-in, sign-out, and similar. So they couldn't match the SAML protocol, which was made just for signing in. But you still needed something for representing tokens, identities, and similar. And the SAML token format, just that part of the protocol, was incredibly fitting for the job. As a result, all those web services protocols, which were token agnostic, that's to say that you can plug whatever type of token you want in there and still use the same protocol, whereas SAML instead was a combo, protocol plus token format, and that's it, they started adopting SAML. So fast forward to today, now you use SAML pretty much everywhere as a token. So in the Microsoft platform, the default token that we use, apart from anti-token when you do Kerberos, is SAML, 2.0, 1.0, and similar. But the default protocol when we do passive stuff is AWS Federation, which is different from the SAML protocol. Now, ADFS supports the SAML protocol as well, not just the token format. And in the future, perhaps access control surveys may, I'm not promising anything, consider adopting that protocol as well. However, today, there is the protocol and the format. Are you worried, are you regretting that you asked? I'm surprised that nobody said, yeah, but we didn't really ask. Anyway, instead, what is this other SWT token? How many of you know what is the SWT token? One, two, three. You know that if you all do this, I don't explain it, and I go forward. So if you want to use it as a trick. No, the SWT token is a special format, is a modern format, which came out about 1 year and a half, 2 years ago, which is much, much slimmer than SAML. SAML is very powerful, can describe anything, and can be used by any protocol to arbitrary levels of security. You can encrypt part of it, you can move asymmetric keys, it's like it's super powerful, it's a tank. But when you want to do REST, in which you are doing calls with put, get, and similar, and typically you want to put things in the HTTP headers, you don't want these big payloads that you send around, then you cannot use SAML in the vast majority of cases, because SAML is fat, it's big. It can be like the smallest, is like, I don't know, 3K. I don't think I've ever seen a SAML token smaller than 3K. So if you put it in an HTTP header, certain networking hardware will actually clip it. Let's say it is just too big. And also, remember, going to do groceries with a tank, you usually go with a bicycle if you want to do the groceries. So the SWT is a token format that came out exactly for getting to this issue. It's much, much smaller. It's not XML, can still be signed, typically with something symmetric, and it is used in the context of things like OAuth. How many of you guys know what is OAuth? Despite my horrible pronunciation. OAuth is a delegation and authorization protocol which came out exactly for enabling REST scenarios, and I'll touch upon that slightly later. Anyway, long story short, not that short, Here, when you tell to the access control service to issue tokens, you can tell it which format to use, and it can use business formats, SAML 1.1, SAML 2.0, or SWT. However, this does not say anything about the protocol. This is just the token format. Then the protocol is decided by the endpoint that you use. And we have a diagram for that. But not immediately. Then here you can say if you want to encrypt the token. For SAML, you can encrypt. For SWT, I don't think you can. And here, basically, it's just require or do not use it. For certain situations, like, for example, you are doing this with a web service, and the channel is in the clear, is HTTP, you must do that. Otherwise, the access control service will not give you a token to begin with, because in HTTP, without encryption, things are insecure. And then finally, here you have how long this token must survive. Here, the default is 600 milliseconds. You can go from the paranoid, like give, I don't know, 40 milliseconds and hope that the guy does everything on time to a couple of days in the case like, but why should I care? Who cares? Give them, or 1 year. Like, you can do whatever. Anyway, here, usually you keep it short, reasonably short, because the more the token is valid without the user coming back to get something, or if not the user, at least something which renews that, the more you are exposed to things like man in the middle, token replay, and all those friends. Then, here you can actually say which identity providers you should use. As you can see here, Live ID is unchecked. I don't want to use it. Let's also say that I don't want to use Google. And then, let me go out a bit. You can decide which rules you want to apply, which we have to see. And then here you have this token signing certificate. In the version 1 of the access control service, we signed the tokens just with symmetric keys, which doesn't always work. It's not very, very solid. Here, you can literally upload whatever certificate you want to use for signing and have it use it. Now here, the usual practical security considerations apply. You are taking one private key and putting it out of your company. We will take good care of that, but somebody may be uncomfortable doing that. So, up to you. Also, since we want to enable the F5 experience, when you create a namespace from scratch, we create a self-signed certificate with a nice long key so that it's already in there, so you don't have to worry about it. Like, if you need something to actually sign your stuff, it's already in there. Of course, that means that you need to distribute it somewhere, which is not always super straightforward. So let me save this. So let's go back home. What else? Here we have rules. Rules are very straightforward. I won't go into the details. I will just, I'll go into the details slightly later. I will say that by default, we don't give out anything. But to say that the fact that I said I trust those identity providers does not entail that I am also passing the information that I receive to the application. I may use that information here for some kind of processing, but then I never share it. Imagine, I don't know, that I have something which does the mapping between the roles, one organization and the application, and I don't want to disclose the role of the user from the company to the application, and I just want to limit the amount of information that is in there. So here, I want to receive it, but I will never send it out. And of course, if I just want to send everything out, I have this generate feature, which I just click, and it works. And then, finally, the last step is integrate to the application. And here, if I go to application integration, I have a list of endpoints, which I will mention later. But the most important one is this guy, the metadata endpoint. The metadata endpoint is corresponding to the one that we have seen from the identity provider and is what we use for establishing our federation. So if I open another Visual Studio, here we see a synergy between our services and our on-premises product. since we use claims all over the place, here I can use my tooling that I have on-premise for using a claims-based identity, and I can just point to my endpoint on the access control service and establish my federation, which is very straightforward. And I'm going fast through this part because I assume that you guys more or less have an idea of that. And so now when I hit play, I'm just going to do the usual back and forth. I am, let's see if I manage to, this morning I didn't manage. This time maybe I will. Here the system is going to hit on my application. Since the application, the middleware will see that I'm not authenticated, it will redirect me. Oop, I didn't, never mind. It will redirect me to my endpoint that is in the namespace that I described here. Since I'm egocentric, I like to put my name all over the place. And then here, I have this thing that helps the user choose, and we'll see how we can customize this easily. And then I can pick just one of those. Do the authentication, and ta-da, I'm authenticated. Here I have all my claims and similar. Here I could show you a bit of normalization, but perhaps we can do it later. Okay, so far we are pretty much in known territory. So let's take a slightly closer look at the flow. Here I have my browser and I have my relying party. Actually, before I go there, how many of you guys know how AWS Federation works? 1, 2, 3, 4. You are a minority, guys, so I have to go through this. So here I'm showing a simplified version of AWS Federation. AWS Federation is the protocol that we just used in here, and it is just how the poor browser is being bounced back and forth. On a positive note, this diagram is simplified, because since the browser is, let's say it, stupid, the only thing that you can ask the browser is for it to render whatever the web server asks it to. So if I wanted to do complex things like moving back and forth, the only way I can do that is to send redirects. Let's say that the user tries to get one resource. This resource requires the user to go somewhere else. So I trick the browser into thinking that resource is in there. So I always think of this dog that comes, I take the ball and I do the gesture and the dog goes and the ball is still in my hands. So and then 302 of the browser are pretty much the same thing. And it's just an artifact for doing the messages. But since it's an artifact, we know that, and so we don't need to show it here. So we gain, we half the number of lines. So here you have your web browser. Here I have my application relying party, and I try to get one page. I'm not authenticated, so my middleware, my Windows Identity Foundation, sends back an HTML plus script. Can you read, guys, or should I zoom? That's okay. Okay. I hit in there, I'm not authenticated, so I send back this request for going somewhere else, and I give you some details, like, for example, the protocol that I want to use, the action that I want you to do, which is sign in, and similar. Then the access control service comes to play, since that's the place where I redirect the browser. And there, I do the get of a list of identity providers. When I use the page, that get comes also with the entire logic for doing the calls. If instead I want to take a control of experience, then I can ask for that JSON and render my own page. In fact, here, I get my list of identity providers. Then I show the page, the one that you have seen with the two buttons, organization 1 and 2. And finally, once I choose one, I actually go to my identity provider and it can be one of those. Here, the experience is in the hand of identity provider. Remember, we are talking about the browser. For web services, the matter is different. And here, we process the login of a user. Once we are happy with that, somehow, we get the token back to the browser. Browser sends it back to the access control service. Here, I'm just not showing it for simplicity. Here, we process the rules that we said. We create a new token, send it back to the relying party, which finally, if it's happy with things like signature and similar, it's done. So there is no magic. That's how it works. It's very, very straightforward. And anything you want to change, you can play with any of those boxes. It's a good way of thinking of that. Like all those boxes are the places where you can make your mark, put your contribution. Everything else is protocol. So if you change it, the protocol will become proprietary and you will break a compatibility. So this is more or less in the end, if we want to be like not very poetic, but just look at practical terms. Your access control service is just this. It's that address, and then you have two categories of relative paths in there. Service ones, in which you use these things for management or for, how to say, in, ancillary functions. And then you have the proper STSs, proper endpoints. So for example, on the top side you have the management portal. All the HTML stuff that you have seen is actually this guy. Then you have the metadata, which we used. You have the list of identity providers, which is the famous JSON source. And then you have the management service, the thing that you can use for managing things without going through the portal. And then here I have my various endpoints. I have one STS for AWS Federation, one STS for AWS Trust for the rich web services, and then I have those two endpoints for doing OAuth. I have two flavors of OAuth because it's too complicated to explain. I don't want to bore you. I would spend 10 minutes of doing a history lesson rather than a technical thing. Suffice to say that the hot thing now, like when people says OAuth 2, they are referring to OAuth 2, this one. So when you think of a Facebook or LinkedIn or those guys that says we support OAuth 2, they are talking about the protocol that we use in that endpoint. In reality, as of today, there are not two implementations of OAuth which interoperates to each other, but that's another story. Instead of a wrap OAuth flavor, is a protocol that was used when OAuth 1.0 was still not claims-based. And so there was this intermediate format which we used for doing our management APIs in V1. And so now, in the new version, we have to carry it over. And you use it just for the management. You could use it also for your app, but I strongly discourage that. Don't do it. If you need to use OAuth, use that other thing. This 13 number that you see in there is not because we are superstitious, but that's because this is the number of the draft of this protocol. OAuth is still in movement. It's not a standard yet. It's just a set of specs, and people are still fighting over the features, the syntax, and similar. So now we are in draft 13, and that's the version that we are doing. So you know when you have to interoperate with this guy, which reference you should use. And now comes the interesting part. Well, interesting. Those are the three endpoints of the STSs which I described. It's easy to fall in the temptation of saying access control service supports OAuth 2, these websites supports OAuth 2, so, well, they can talk, right? Not necessarily. That's to say that those protocols can be approached only using certain clients. Let's say that, for example, AWS Federation can be used only with a browser. AWS Trust can be used only with a web service. And also there are the implementation choices of various providers. So if Facebook does not give me any way of authenticating without a browser, the only way of authenticating is popping out a browser, well, that's the way in which I get to Facebook. So even if I have a programmatic endpoint for 2.0, for OAuth 2.0, I still need to pop up a browser. But this is very abstract, so I made a diagram that hopefully will show it. But it will work only if you pay attention, because this is hard. And I know that this stuff is hard, I can see it on your faces, and I really feel bad, but I have to give you the deep dive. Otherwise, you'd write in Twitter, oh, the Italian hippie said deep dive and is doing the intro. And instead, we have to do that. So be patient still for 25 minutes. So there I have those three things that are literally what you see on the surface, what you see outside of the access control service. And all the vertical band in there is the access control service. Then on this side you have your applications. And let's say, for example, that your application is a website. So if it's a website, the endpoint that you want to use for talking to access control service is AWS Federation. And what are the identity providers that you can engage in that case? Well, there is Live, there is Google, there is Facebook, there are any endpoints with WS Federation, and there are OpenID endpoints. Those are the guys that you can use. And in fact, let's say that we pick LiveID, the flow is you go from LiveID to that endpoint, so all the diagram that I've designed before is following that direction, and first thing when we get the request is we validate the protocol. We see that you are following all the various procedures. Then we verify that you are actually among the identity providers that we like. Then finally, we mangle your claims, and then we do the opposite in the exit. We manufacture the token, we make sure that the application that is asking for it is an application that we told the ACS about, the relying party, and then finally we package all this thing, and this token, comes out of the hole of WS Federation and gets to your website. And here, as we have seen, you can get SAML tokens or SWT tokens. That's not the case everywhere. All those guys are identity providers that I can use in here. And those are the ones that I use for the browser. Now, let's say that you create a SOAP web service. This could be the web service for paying the salaries, so something for which you need a strong security. You need a non-repudiation, so signing things with asymmetric keys. So at that point, what are the identity providers that you can deal with? You can deal with other WS Trust sources or SWTs. You cannot deal with those other guys. But to say that, I'll say in a moment. The other things that you can do, which unfortunately a lot of people do also when they shouldn't, is to obtain WS Trust tokens using service identities. Let me go back to the portal. What is a service identity? I went too far. A service identity is a credential, basically, which I created artificially on my portal. Oh, eventually I'll get it, yes. So if I don't want to use the access control service as a federation provider, as a broker, but I need to actually use a username password or a certificate or a symmetric key for obtaining a token directly, then I can actually create those service identities. Usually you use those capabilities for maintenance reasons. So you don't want to create a password here and then distribute it to your customers, because then you are back to square one. Why are you using ACS again? Those identities are designed to do things like creating rules programmatically or adding or deleting identity providers, and doing so in ways that, for example, you delegate to your own customers. So let's say that you own this namespace, but you want your customer to be able to change just that relying party. You can create a service identity here, give it to them, and limit their scope just to that thing. So please don't use those service identities as a general purpose identities, because that's defying the reason for which you'd use the access control service in the first place. And anyway, those are the only guys that you can use for getting a token using WS Trust. In other words, if you're right, this is the point. Like, if you don't pay attention to the rest, that's fine, but just the next 10 words have it in your head. If you're writing a WS security service, the only place where you can get identities from are those, the one on the yellow. The fact that the access control service supports both WS security and Facebook doesn't mean that you can do a match between the two. Now, you can do tricks for making this happen. So, for example, you could set up something here in which somehow you show a browser, you go through the cycle for getting a token, and once you get a token, you inject it in here so that, like, you basically do a circuit. Like, you write something in your app that can actually do this, in which you close the circle in your hand. But that means that you have to do explicit steps, like, for example, popping out a browser, having the user go through this experience, and then have logic which grabs the resulting token and injects it in this call so that it works. So technically it can be done, but it does not work out of the box. And it's not that it doesn't work out of the box because we are lazy, because that's intrinsic to the way in which the protocols work, as I hope I managed to show you here. And the same goes for auth. If you have a REST web service, you don't want to use the AWS Trust endpoint, but you want to use the auth wrap or 2.0 endpoint. And here, the places from where you can get identities are mostly the same as AWS Trust. And here it is. So this diagram, well, you'll get the slides, so you can grab it. But this diagram is also available on the internet. If you are lost, if you don't know if your scenario is supported, grab this and literally make the little circuit. Start from where you want to get identities, follow the lines, and if you see that you want to exit from another hall, you know that you have to provide something which brings the ball back into the circuit. Questions? The question is there a source code for the injection? And the answer is, yes, sir, there is. Not for the Cartesian product of all the possible combinations, but we have various scenarios, such as, for example, the phone scenario, in which we actually pop out a browser, get a SWT token, and then we use it for calling a REST web service. So we do this protocol transition by hand. Okay, so a bit more about HomeRAM discovery. So far we have seen the brute force. We just showed the list of possible options with the big buttons. We can also use a list of JSON in which, I may have made a mistake. We can actually go through a list of identity providers, get it in our code, and then use it for customizing the experience. And in fact, I don't know if I still have it, but I may. There are a bunch of guys in Ohio which created an online game. Online game that has nothing to do with identity. It's like something like post-apocalyptic in which people have to go in dome the cities underwater, and for surviving they have to get the favor of the gods. Okay. But the interesting thing is that those guys have skills in graphic, clearly, and also in, I don't need to actually go deeper. And also in, strategy, like they are game developers. They don't care, absolutely don't care about authentication. And so what they've done is they went to the access control service and they created this little thing in which substantially they offer you the possibility of using whatever account you want, which is, again, very valuable because there is an incredibly high percentage of people that will not sign up to your site if they have to create a new account. And here, you can just reuse things. And actually, I don't know if I have the beta code, so I will not actually do it, but luckily, I'm already making my point. As you can see here, the experience is much better than our big blue buttons, and they are just manipulating it in whatever way they want. And in fact, they told me that thanks to this, they reduced their... they were thinking of integrating with LiveID and Facebook directly, and by using the access control service, they integrated with all of them in one-third of the time that they thought it would be necessary for just two. So, pretty good. The other thing that we can do is do domain-based discovery. Easier shown than explained. Let me go back to my list of identity providers. Here we have our identity providers. Let me go to organization one. Here I get display name and the login text link, but I also get this feature in which if I put the name of the domain where the users are coming from, and then I have the user type their email address when it's the moment to choose which identity provider I should use, then I don't need to show them the list, because I can understand from where they are coming from just by looking at their domain. So now I'm famous for my bad memory, so let me take a look here at what is the domain. Domain is Customer.org 1. Good. So here I'll just say Customer.org 1. Great. Let me save. And now let's go to org 2. And something tells me that the domain is Customer.org 2. I may be wrong, but that's fine. Okay, now we may have a little bug that will do things a bit garbled, but that shouldn't stop me from showing you how it works. So now here I'm hitting play. As usual, I didn't change any code on this side. And now, when I will hit the list of identity providers, now Access Control Service has more information about those. And again, let's see if I... Yeah, there is the bug. Okay, never mind. So now you have this, sign in using your email address. So I don't know that's org1, org2, and similar. Only thing I know is that I am Joe at, I forgot the at, customer.org1. And now when I hit submit, the Access Control Service sends me directly to the right place. So I didn't have to disclose the list of all my users, which is good when your customers are competitors of each other, which is very often the case, because when you offer a service, typically your set of customers are more or less in the same business, which is great. There are ways that are even more direct for doing this, which are largely in terms of, instead of leaving the option, you can, when you give out the link to the application, embed one parameter in the URL, which points already to your identity provider. So that when the application gets it and passes it along to the Access Control Service, the Access Control Service sees that there is already this information and it will forward you in the right place. Note, this is one of the reasons for which it's really, really, really a good idea to always use HTTPS. Because when you use HTTPS, also the URL is protected. And if it isn't, people may happily attach this parameter to your URL, bring you in some website somewhere else. This website may look exactly like Facebook, for example, and your happy user would type their credentials and be in trouble. So the rules, as we have seen, are super straightforward. There's really nothing weird with those. The rules can be grouped in rule groups. And the reason for that is so that it's easier for you to assign them around, so that they are more manageable. And so that you can, for example, selectively turn them on and off depending on with whom you are talking with. And rules can, in this release, are very, very, very basic. It's just mapping, in which you can go start from knowing practically nothing. Like you just know from where you are getting the token, and then you can decide to assign something. You don't need to actually know any other thing. Like you can say, if you're coming from Facebook, I want to add this claim. That's exactly what the Access Control Service does when it adds that extra claim that says identity provider. Or you can add the type and saying, if you see this type, then do this action, which is what we do with the pass-through rules. When we have pass-through rules, we say, well, I'm getting a token from this issuer. There is this type. I want exactly the same to go through, so that you can selectively let the information through without necessarily showing the entire thing. And then, of course, you can get more and more specific and say, if you are from this issuer, you have this type, and this type has this value. At that point, you can add stuff. And again, also the output part can be very generic. The only thing that you cannot specify is the issuer, because the issuer is intrinsic in the fact that you are in that namespace. If you would want to issue from somewhere else, you'd be somewhere else. All with me? Good, I see nodding. Great. Management APIs. The management APIs are very handy. How many of you guys ever used OData? Great. How many of you guys know what OData is? Excellent. OData is a REST set of protocols that you can use for doing interesting things, such as, for example, making queries on a set of resources or choosing which kind of resources you want to retrieve without really having much stuff on the client side. It's very, very handy. It's used all over the place. We have a set of APIs, which in fact we already had in V1 and the portal we added later, which are way more powerful than the portal. The portal is nice for me to do a demo, and for you for doing a little adjustments and similar. But if you wanted to do the real thing, that's to say, having all these as part of your process, as part of your provisioning, or for automating maintenance and similar, usually you will go with APIs. And those APIs are absolutely straightforward to use. We have really a lot of examples in all our samples, labs, and similar. So for example, for setting up the lab of a phone, like we have in the Identity Training Kit and in the Windows Azure Training Kit, we have a lab which shows you how to build applications which will use the phone and the access control service. And we have a start solution and an end solution. Now, the interesting thing of things in the cloud are that the end solution is not just the bits of what you developed in the lab, but also the things that you set up on the lab. So it would be very hard for me to give you an end solution without also giving you a little script that will do in one pass all the things that instead you had the instruction to do in the exercise. And that's exactly what we do. So what we have in here, let me see if it's the right one, is the code, which I will not go into the details, I just want you to know that it exists, the code of the setup that we use for creating the end solution, in which here, substantially, we have just a wrapper on the OData proxy, which makes all the various calls to those APIs. And this wrapper has all sorts of goodies, which you can reuse if you want. Let me see if I manage to show them up in the right way. Yes. Here you can see all these little things like adding an identity provider, and you can do it by passing directly the element. Or adding Facebook, which is a special flavor of identity provider because it requires the application ID, the application keys, and similar. In other words, you have all these wrappers against OData that you can use for automating pretty much any setup that you want. And if some of you guys are really, really brave and will show up at the session about SaaS and Windows Azure later, I will show one complete SaaS solution in which you never get on the portal, but we use all those things for provisioning automatically new instances of a software as a service solution. And we use all those. But if you want to use the data directly, you can actually do that. How many of you guys ever saw this Sesame data browser? Yesterday? Was it Clemens Wasters? Because I told him. That's great. I'm glad that he used my tip. And this thing is actually just a generic client for data. And what you see in here, and actually I think that I have, yes, a zoom. What you see in here is a top-level query in which this generic browser actually got all the entities that I have in my access control service namespace. So for example, here I have a list of issuers that I'm trusting. Of course, here I'm doing the huge fonts for your benefits, but normally I can handle this. Or, for example, I have my list of rules. And here I have just a bunch of them, not a lot of them. But if you think about it, you can easily have many thousands of those. And going through the rules in the portal, and there's many thousands of them with 20 per time since it's paginated per 20 rules or 10, it's actually kind of a pain. So here you can do everything that normally you would do with OData. So let's say that, for example, I'm interested only in the rules, which somehow have to do with name. So this name and this name identity and similar. So here I can just come to this filter and go to the claim type, type name, and say that my filter is going to be contains. It filters, and now I restricted my list of rules just to names. And I mean, you can dream up whatever other way you want for manipulating this thing. It's just the data. So you can pretty much automate anything. That's very, very, very powerful. Let me get back to the slideware. I will skip the crypto fun, simply because we have a few minutes left, and I don't think that you guys can take it. Unless you ask me to. Do you want to see why you need the keys here and there, or why you need certain certificates, private, public, and similar, or do you want to talk about data delegation? Or data delegation. You have been saved. Okay, before getting to there, which we can now to say overflow, as soon as the timer stops, I'll have to run because the ladies have to set up all these monstrous things. I don't want to get caught in the middle. But so let me just tell you what are we looking at for the future, and then as soon as we are done with that, we can talk about the OData thing, the OAuth thing. So on the radar for the future, there are definitely more protocols. We see that you guys like choice, and every time we add a protocol, we unlock big amounts of users. And the SAML protocol, which I mentioned before, is on big demand, especially in places like Scandinavia and similar. SAML is all over the place. So people would really, really like us to support it, and so we are considering it very seriously. And then there are, of course, OAuth is a moving target, it keeps changing, it's very important, as the question has shown, and so we will definitely need to go back to that and change it according to how the specification changes. Then, the SWT token format, which I described, is actually a reasonably proprietary format, meaning that we put out the specification, but pretty much nobody picked it up. And at the same time, others are actually agreeing on a different format, a JSON web token, which is in spirit the same as SWT, but it's just based on JSON and also has very, very interesting features, such as, for example, the asymmetric signatures. The SWT can use only symmetric signatures, and that means that it's pretty hard to use beyond the classic API key scenario. Like, unless you are doing an API and the key is being kept on a server, then it's pretty hard. Like, if, for example, you want a phone to call you, you'd have to give them the key. And this key is now on the device, and good luck with securing that. Unless you have hardware which is dedicated to that, it's complicated. So asymmetric signatures are a very good thing. JSON is a good thing. As soon as this thing will reach a level of maturity, which makes sense, don't be surprised if you see it popping up. Then, I didn't touch on authorization because it's a very painful topic. It's like everybody thinks everything and the opposite of everything of it. Access control service can be used to some specific scenarios of authorization, which the main one being no token and no party, meaning that if you take a dependency of the access control service for getting a token, if the rules do not yield to a token which has claims, you will get an error. So if you want to authorize somebody, you can do that. Also, you can actually put there, concentrate your authorization logic so that you can do mappings and similar already at the access control service level. It's the policy decision point. And then in your application, all you need to do is the policy enforcement point. Of course, there are complications like, for example, the fact that you don't have a payload available at the ACS, you see only the token but not what's inside the message. So spending limit doesn't work because I don't know how much you're trying to buy. But we are thinking about this, and you'll see some more rich capability for authorization in the future. And also, HDR is a kind of a bare bone now with those big blue buttons. We may do something about it. And management tooling, things like OData, is nice and generic, but probably some domain-specific thing may come out. And that said, I'm glad to grab your questions about the specific scenario that we just described, which would be very specific anyway. And I would thank you for your bravery, for braving the entire session until the end. Thank you.